You are listening to the Accents podcast on WUKY. I'm your host, Katerina Stoikova, and my guest today is writer Ellen Burkett Morris. Hi, Ellen, how are you today?
I'm good. Thank you so much.
You have a book coming out soon, Beware the Tall Grass. Congratulations.
Thanks so much. I'm very excited. This one was 8 years in the making. So I'm glad that it's out in the world or will be on March 15th. So,
well, this book has a story. Please tell us the story of this award-winning book.
oh, absolutely. The origin story of this is that I was in the car with my husband in 2014 doing a road trip, and it's NPR Weekend was on. And they played a story about a researcher who looked into children, young children with past life memories. And the idea was so intriguing to me right away that I knew I had to do something with it. And so I first wrote it as a short story with a focus on a particular family, the Sloan family, and what happens when this mother thinks she's getting a blank slate. A child who she can give a perfect life to, and she discovers that he has these very traumatic sort of memories of being in Vietnam. Wrote it as a short story. It got published in the Upstreet Journal. Went to a workshop, and I had a teacher say, you know, this really seems like a novel. And so I decided to expand it out. So it's both the story of the Sloan family, and it's the story of Thomas Boone, a young man who suffers a loss, falls in love, and goes off to Vietnam. And what I've got is a dual narrative story that weaves those two stories together.
You said 8 years.
Yes.
How did the book change? What happens in the life of a novel writer year after year, and then 8 years later, you have it?
Absolutely. I'm glad to talk about that because I hope that other people could take some hints from me and maybe not take 8 years to get their thing in the world, to get their book in the world. But for me, what happened was I wrote it. I showed it to writers groups. I took it to writing workshops. At one point, I had an agent, but the agent that I had wasn't really doing a great job of giving me feedback, helping me improve it. He wasn't communicating with me very well. Come to find out, he's asked to resign from the agents' representatives organization for not being very ethical. So I had to say goodbye to him, as much as I hoped and dreamed that he would find a home for it. And so I've been through writing, rewriting, having the agent. And finally, I figured out there's something, I think I'm close, but there's something I don't know. And who is going to know what I don't know? And the answer to that question was a developmental editor. So I ended up going through a place called New York Book Editors that assigned me to a fellow who had previously been a literary agent who read the book and was able to say, okay, this is working, but in this area, you might turn up the volume a little bit here, make this a bit more dramatic. He gave me really great concrete suggestions that allowed me to turn this almost there book into a book that was there. At that point, I was really, I wasn't sure I wanted to go back into the agent search after having had a bad experience. So I started to look at prizes and academic presses and came across the Donald L. Jordan Prize, which is through Columbus State University. And the prize had a tagline that said that they wanted books that were about integrity and about the American experience. And I thought, I think this book, particularly The Experience of the Soldier, embodies this idea of integrity. So I'm going to send it to the contest. I sent it twice, once before I worked with the developmental editor and they passed on it, then a second time after I got the edit and worked on it. And that's when the book was accepted. So it was clear to me that I had gotten the kind of feedback I needed to make the story the best that it could be. And I've been so pleased to work with Columbus State University Press and the editor of the series, whose name is Alan G. He's been fantastic. I've continued to learn from him as he's given me editing suggestions and as we've worked through the process together.
Wow, I almost wanna listen from the beginning of this conversation and to count the word editing, because you're editing on your own, then you try to get editing from an agent, then you got a developmental editor, and then you worked on more editing with the editor of the press. That is a lot of work.
It is a lot of work. And you know, the other thing that I did for myself with this book was that I gave myself time to really figure out where the story was. So, you know, we write and we think we know what it is we want to say, but truthfully, we have to live with it. We have to live with the characters and the dilemma to really figure out where the heart of the story is. And sometimes that takes time, you know, to really get to that. And so I was really, you know, as frustrated as I was at various points and even hopeless, you know, feeling hopeless at times, you know, I really let myself abide with the story, to be with the story and figure out what it was I needed to say. And yeah, and that idea of, and the editing, you know, I used to, when I first started writing, editing sort of irritated me, or, you know, I didn't love it. And I've grown to love it because every time you go back in, you find new and better ways to say what it is you're trying to say, or to streamline your prose, or to make it sharper or more vivid or more touching. And so I, you know, I've grown to really love that process instead of dread it.
Is there a danger of becoming too close to it, too inside it? When do you need to step out in order to be able to step back in?
Right. And you know, that's a great thought. But I've heard the writer Lee Martin, who's based in Ohio but teaches through the Spalding Low Res program here, talks about putting a manuscript in a drawer and letting it cool off so that you can get some kind of perspective on it. You know, I think also getting a developmental editor or outside readers also helps you get kind of out of, you know, get out of your own head and get other people's view on what it is you've tried to do and whether or not you've pulled it off. But you're absolutely right that that can be a danger, that you can get so in it in a way, or even get kind of really attached to your choices, and not willing to change it and make it better.
Who are Eve, Thomas, Bo?
Eve Sloan is a mother who has a baby and thinks to herself, I'm going to be able to make up for everything wrong that happened in my childhood. I'm going to be able to give this child a perfect childhood. She wants that. She hopes that. It's sort of her mission in a way. And then she finds out that this young child has these memories, these traumatic memories. And then her mission becomes, how do I make him feel safe? How do I figure out what it is that's happening to my child and help him through this ordeal? So she kind of learns to give up those hopes and dreams she had and to focus, laser focus, on advocating for the child that she does have. In the meantime, the other part of the story involves Thomas. Thomas Boone is a young man growing up in Montana who really loves nature, who really loves his horse, who gets a horse at a young age, loves the way it makes him feel. And then he's a senior in high school, and an accident happens, and he has to say goodbye to his horse. And It's the kind of loss that makes him rethink his purpose. He ends up enlisting to go to Vietnam, and then becomes then really his life. He's tested. He's tested in ways he would never imagine he might be tested. And with Thomas, character is the thing. He's always asking himself what the right thing to do is. Even when it's the hardest thing.
A book about integrity.
I think so.
A quote from the book, "Beware the tall grass. Nothing good ever happens there." Do you really believe that?
Certainly in the writing of the book, I came to believe that the tall grass was the setting for some really challenging things. But it's funny when I think about my own personal experience. I wasn't a kid who played a lot of sports or did anything like that, but I was the kid who would go out to the front yard, sit in the grass, however tall it might be, look at the flowers, look at the insects, look at the sun shining down on the drops of dew on the grass. And so for me, the grass was a refuge. That was sort of a way to explore and be with nature that didn't necessarily involve a long hike or something like that, something real super sporty. And so it's funny. It could, I suppose, it can be both heaven and hell, depending upon what's happening there.
Would you kindly read us a passage from the book?
Oh, absolutely, I'll do that. I think what I'll do is just start with the beginning and read a passage that is from Eve's perspective. The quote that comes before the book is from the poem Confluence by Yusuf Kamanyaka. I've been here before, dreaming myself backwards among grappling hooks of light. True to the seasons, I've lived every word spoken. Did I walk into someone's nightmare? So the first section is Eve's. Charlie was here. For a moment, my connection to him was visible. The cord pulsed with blood, then went still. The doctor clamped it, tied it off, cut it. A twinge echoed deep in my belly. He pulled the blanket over me, and the nurse swaddled Charlie. I watched the nurse through the glare of the fluorescent lights, the air scented with a strange mix of blood and commercial cleaners. Charlie seemed so far away, like an untethered astronaut, the thin cable connecting him to the mothership severed. This is ground control to Major Tom. I'd wanted this my whole life, but now I was wondering what the hell we were doing. Dan smiled at me. I smiled back, feeling shaky inside. The nurse handed Charlie to me. I ran my fingers across his small hands. I unwrapped the blanket and rubbed his belly. What's this? I pointed to a small brown oval on the left side of his belly. Birthmark, said the nurse. I had a flash of sadness. I had imagined him as a blank slate, unmarked by life. I pushed the feeling away, looking into his small eyes, stroking his fine hair. May I, Dan asked. He held up his cell phone to get a picture. Really, right now? I put a smile on my face and looked down at Charlie. Dan's phone pinged as people texted congratulations. We were connected to friends by the ether, connected to Charlie by blood. It was strange that in that moment I felt singularly alone, thinking about my hopes for this tiny person, his small weight against my heart in a room pulsing with activity.
Wow, thank you, Evan. What makes a good novel?
Well, I've done a lot of classes with folks and I hear different things. I think part of what makes a good novel is that you take a promising idea and you take people through the dramatic ups and downs of whatever the setup and scenario is, and you end in a place of deeper understanding. I've heard different things from different teachers, but I took a workshop with the writer Lee K. Abbott. And I was talking to him about this novel, and he said, "Well, Have you exploited the dramatic potential of the situations? And, to me, that kind of read as, have you turned up the volume enough on the things that are going to make the reader feel like they're really involved, like there's really a threat or something's at stake here? And that was hugely helpful in helping me sort of pace the novel. But, I think we want the ups and downs. We want to take that ride with folks. But ultimately, we want to end up in a place where we feel like we've gained some insight, or the characters have gained some insight, and they know something now that they didn't know before. They understand the world in a different way, something along those lines.
A quote from an interview with you. Nobody needed my story, but I had to write it. Say more, please.
Okay, certainly, certainly. I think we're all in this position when we write, so I was in another workshop with a short story writer, Ron Carlson, and he looked at the group and he said, "There is no mandate for your work. Nobody is waiting for your work." He said that was true of him as well, and he'd had stories published in the New Yorker, and it was like, well, sort of felt slapped in the face, but at the same time, to realize that that's the case, but I'm going to do it anyway. It's really, really powerful, and so I think as writers, we need to stay motivated by our own internal desire to tell the story that we're telling. And we may not know why we're telling it when we're doing it. To get personal for a moment, when I started writing this, I had just turned 50, just been diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis, and my mother had just been diagnosed with lung cancer, terminal lung cancer. So I'm in this situation with a lot of very difficult stuff in my life. And for some reason, I found myself pulled to this very difficult story about love and courage and advocacy, all of the things that I needed in my life at that point, all of the things we were dealing with, being courageous in the face of challenging medical news, advocating for each other, that sort of stuff. So I didn't only realized it just this past year that there was a way in which telling this story was living out on the page something that I was living in my life. It was dealing with similar themes and helping me work through them through fiction. When it was maybe too difficult to work through them face to face, in life. That's sort of what I discovered about what I was doing at that point.
Sounds to me like it's a matter of following one's personal integrity.
I'd say so. Yeah. And we discover what matters to us, what we care about, and even who we are as we do that work.
Writing is a series of choices. That's another quote by you from that same interview. You are an author of short stories, poetry, and a novel. Which genre comes most naturally to you?
Oh, it's short stories. I absolutely love writing short, and I love the fact that in a short story you can just zoom right into the heart of what's going on. That I'm not a I don't love scene setting. I don't love long elaborate descriptions. I really love putting you with a character at a moment that's very pivotal in their life and having something play out on the page. And so, yeah, short stories are the ones that I think come to me most naturally and most easily. And they're, I've read a lot of short stories as well, so.
Well, this is our third interview. Once you came for a poetry book, and once you came for a short story collection, and now for a novel. Are you going to try another genre at some point?
In preparation for getting this book into the world, I'm writing some essays, and I'm working on one now for a lady's blog that talks about my path to publication and the fact that I've worked with multiple publishers. I know that's something that you're tackling in a book, how to, all of the steps of putting together a collection of poetry. People really want and need to know how to navigate that world. So I'm working on an essay about that. I'm working on an essay about truth in fiction, and how much of me is in this book, based on kind of what I just told you about what I was going through at the time. So yeah, so I'm working on some essays. I also have another novel that I'm revising that I kind of thought was finished, but may not be. So I'm working on that as well. And I've got another collection of short stories that I'm sending around, that's called The Home Repair Manual. That's kind of set of dealing with people's idea of home and family and that sort of thing, and what can go wrong there. So
I want to get back to your novel, and I would like to know what kind of research you did on past lives or anything related to that.
yes, absolutely. So I looked up books that had been written, scientific books about research into past life memories. I also looked at websites that were a little further afield, a little less science-based, just to see how people talked about that experience and what made up that experience for children. So oftentimes it's something like they know how to do something they shouldn't know how to do. So they're 3 years old and they can put a gun together. Or they know details about a battle that they should, a specific battle that like they shouldn't know. So all of that was super fascinating to me. I also looked up sort of what would be the progression for what would you do for kids. So maybe you go to the doctor, then you go to a neurologist, a psychologist, a past life regressionist. On the Vietnam side, I've read some first person accounts that were online. I read a lovely book called They Were Soldiers Once and Young that had to do, that was set in Vietnam, written by a soldier and his commanding officer. I interviewed my uncle who had been to Vietnam and talked to him a little bit about what the experience was like on the ground there. I was really drawn to Vietnam because I have an uncle who I'm very close to and a cousin of my husband's who I also adore. And they were both really touched by their experiences in the war. One of them negatively, more negatively, and the other one, came home and became a firefighter and channeled all of the energy that he had, all the adrenaline that he had from being in war and doing a job that saved people. And so, caring about them as I did, I wanted to imagine, I wanted to sort of explore through fiction what that experience might have been like to be there. So those were my go-tos in terms of research.
So the children who remember their past lives, do they forget? And if they forget, what age normally?
Normally, what happens is, I would say, from what I read, they would say like 6 or 7, like about the time that people really begin to form their own memories, those other memories fade away for those kids, and they don't bring it up again. And what's been most remarkable to me is since I wrote the book, when I talk to people about it, people will tell me, like I had a guy at the Louisville Book Festival sitting next to me, and we were talking about the book, and he said, "Oh, my son did that." He said to us, "Oh, that's the factory where I worked, and I had a red truck, and I got in a car wreck, and that's how I died." And I mean, it's really mind-blowing to think that, that some people have these kinds of experiences. And yeah, and more than anything else, I was just so curious about as a parent, how would you deal with it? Because it would have to scare the daylights out of you.
It would give you a unique view into the past and how people used to live and how people used to think. It's almost as if you receive a computer and the previous software hasn't been entirely wiped out. But it also sounds like it gets overwritten little by little.
Yeah, that's a great metaphor for that process. And I'd love to believe that time's a continuum. After my father died, I went to Ireland, and there was a fellow there who was able to show me the parish church where our relatives who left Ireland during the time of the famine and came to Canada. He showed me the church where they had worshiped before they left Ireland. And I was standing on this hillside looking at the ruins of this church, at these Celtic crosses, and missing my father. But suddenly I felt like, okay, this time is a continuum and we're all on it, whether we're present here physically or not. And it was a great comfort in the midst of grief to feel like part of something larger and to take that kind of view on history. And this kind of idea in the book kind of adds an additional wrinkle, that perhaps we show up again at different times on the continuum.
Did writing this book and researching on it change your relationship with time?
Oh gosh, that is such an interesting question. I'm not really sure. I do know that I felt during the pandemic that time really slowed, and now that things are getting back to normal, it seems as if time is breezing by. And of course, the older I get, the more that seems to happen. It's like, oh, it's Friday again, but I do think it was fun to explore ideas of time and to think about it and to get a way to think about it. And I do think the one thing that for most of us slows time down is sitting down to write a book. And when you're in the room doing the work, there's just nothing but time in front of you, and that's kind of lovely.
Really, to me, time disappears when I write and I feel like I'm into it.
It's so, I guess I get a feeling of expansiveness, and maybe that's because I'm exploring other worlds, but it's interesting that it's different for all of us, but just as the writing process is so different for all of us.
What was the most difficult aspect of writing this book?
I think there is a point in the middle of every work that people write where you suddenly say, oh, wait a minute, what am I doing exactly, and where do I need to go from here? So getting over the difficult middle, finding a way toward the end, toward a resolution of sorts, was challenging. I think also hanging with the getting it published was challenging. So a week before they contacted me in January of last year to say that the book was a finalist for the prize. A week before they contacted me, I thought, maybe this just isn't any good, as we do. I just had that crisis in faith. No, I'm not hearing from anybody. Maybe it's not any good. And so that was kind of challenging mentally to say, okay, have faith, keep going, keep sending, believe in the story, believe in yourself. You're going to have those moments of discouragement, but ultimately, you're going to do what you can to get it into the world. So,
I have one last question for you, and that is the question that I ask all my guests who teach creative writing or teach workshops sometimes, and that is, what is the most important thing you teach your students? If you want them to remember one thing from you, what is it?
yeah, the one thing I try to tell them, whether it's poetry or essays or short stories or novels, is that detail, vivid, unique, particular detail related to the character, related to the place, related to the thing you're talking about in your poem, is your way into meaning. So you want to make sure that you have solid, concrete, unique details in there that make this piece come alive for your readers. So, in the part that I read to you, the smells, the way the lights are on her, the sounds, The physical activities that are happening in the room are always to build that world. And so if you can get comfortable with doing that and then doing your best to make it very particular to the person. So when she thinks about the cutting of the cord, she thinks of the David Bowie Ground Control to Major Tom. Each character is going to think a different thing at that point because they're very particular, unique sort of people. So the more unique you can make it, the more detailed, and you can always take out detail later, but give those to yourself so that you can use them to help discover the rest of your piece. That's what I tell folks.
And I wish for us in not too distant future, not 8 years from now, that you come back on the show and we talk about your collection of essays. That will be another genre, right?
Sounds wonderful. That would be my pleasure.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Ellen. Wonderful to speak to you.
Thank you, you too.